Welcome to Don't Pass Me By with me, your host, Bob Wilson. I'm joined with a co-host who had really done so much to produce this and bring everyone together. We give thanks to Jude Sutherland Kessler and our excellent John Lennon series books, which you can't miss. Today, she brings along with her two of her friends and my friends, too. We have Ivor Davis and Arthur Schreiber. And they are on today. We're remembering 1963. Where were we in 63? Well, so much was going on at that time, and these guys wrote about it for us. They were the scribes of the nation. They'd been in so many important places, covering so many important cases. And they're not going to let us down today. They're going to tell us all about some of their experiences in doing that. So welcome, Ivor and Arthur. How are you?
Thank you very much.
We're honored to have both of you. I know, Ivor, back in that day, you were the foreign correspondent for the London Daily Express, and Art, you were working for the Westinghouse Network. So you guys, as Bob said, I love that introduction, Bob. So many places, and I mean, you were there telling it like it was. And Bob and I thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Now, gentlemen, I've often said I watch the movie Zelig from time to time, and I always think of Mr. Davis, although Arthur gives him a run for his money, and who was in more places, incredible places at more times, at important points in history. But I want to bring up, on a serious note, the case of James Meredith and went on with that, and I know you guys covered it, and that era, and so much tumult in America at that time, so... Ivor and Art, what do you guys say regarding your coverage of James Meredith?
Well, this is Art Schreiber. I'd like to ask Ivor. Ivor, I covered the James Meredith march across Mississippi, but when he started that march, he was shot and wounded. He recovered, and that's when that's when Martin Luther King and all the other civil rights leaders joined him, and it was a huge march across Mississippi. But I think that was after you covered him trying to get into the university.
That's correct, Arthur. So why don't I go first, and then you can pick up the story. That's exactly it. So it was in the autumn of 1962, and I was actually a bachelor and doing my own laundry in the laundromat. Now, I bring this important topic up because I seldom did my laundry. I built it up for about 4 weeks of laundry. I took a bag and went to the laundromat. While I was there, I heard about James Meredith going to be enrolled the following day at Ole Miss, University of Oxford, Mississippi. So I put my dirty laundry back into my car, and I say that because I had to live with dirty laundry. I'm sorry, I know I don't want to make light of it, but I remember that vividly. Anyway, so I quickly raced, dumped my laundry at my apartment, and raced got a plane to Oxford, Mississippi. Well, I didn't get all the way to Oxford, Mississippi. I think I went to Memphis and I drove. I vaguely remember that. Anyway, it was a fantastic story, and I knew it was a big story, and London knew it was a big story. And just by way of background, as Arthur had mentioned, Meredith, who, by the way, is alive today, is about 89 years of age.
Wow.
Would you believe? Yeah. And he's been, you know, I mean, a sort of a marker for civil rights for so long. So I finally got there, and I was kind of a young, naive journalist, and I marched onto the campus, and they said, "You're not allowed on the campus. We're not allowing media to go on the campus," because by that time, we learned that James Meredith was going to be enrolled in a day or two, and he was going to have 90 U.S. Marshals that had flown in from around the country to escort him on campus. Well, I want to tell you that by the time I got there, it was very, very dangerous. Trouble had broken out. The local people did not want Meredith. They just didn't want a black man attending their all-white college. university. And, of course, the governor got involved, and Kennedy wanted to use this as a touchstone for the civil rights movement, and it turned out to be that way. So Ivor Davis, the young journalist who knew bugger all about what was going on in civil rights, I'd only been in the country for a couple of years. What does a Londoner know about American civil rights? Zilch, zilch. So I go onto the campus, and they say, you can't come on, you're a journalist. So I had the good sense to befriend a couple of students and said, look, I'm from England. Can you take me on as a student? So they did. They smuggled me on the campus. And it was quite remarkable because from the campus windows, I could see the rioting going on. I mean, there was shooting. There were people burning cars. It was pretty horrible. And I remember that night I went to bed maybe at 3 o'clock in the morning. I slept on a sort of they gave me a little air cushion thing, mattress. And then when I woke up the next morning, I discovered that two people had been murdered. And one of them, would you believe, was a British journalist. And I forget his name. I'm sorry, I should have looked it up. Well, I want to tell you, when I called in with the story, my office said, you're alive. I said, yeah, I wouldn't be on the bloody phone. It was another freelance journalist who had been shot and killed. And that, you know, I forget his name, and one other person. But the damage, the mayhem was pretty awful. And I found myself with this front row seat to what was going on. Now, I must admit that I didn't know who General Edwin Walker was. I soon learned. But General Edwin Walker was a distinguished military man who was also very, I guess, right-wing, very conservative in his beliefs. And he kind of, as a military man, he actually encouraged the rioters, which is amazing. And really? I believe, and Arthur may remind me of this, whether at some stage General Edwin Walker was arrested. And at the point was, he was arrested. He became a sort of a touchstone burning figure for this, because he did not want University, Oxford, Mississippi, Ole Miss to have a black student on campus.
If I can interject one second, was the gentleman's name, and correct me if I'm wrong, Paul Gihard?
That was him, yes. That was him. Paul, exactly. Thanks for looking it up. And there was one other person that was killed. But Paul was working as a journalist for England. And, you know, the chances of two journalists from England being on the same spot and one of them being bumped off, I mean, unfortunately, you know, terrible way to end a life anyway. But, you know, I never really thought about it until years later. I guess you go on with your life, and then suddenly when you look back at history, and I think Arthur will probably attest to it, you realize other things should have been going on in your mind, but you don't. When history is unfolding, you just witness it, you write about it, and you don't look at the consequences. One other thing that, and I don't want to monopolize the conversation, but the other interesting thing that I discovered later was that somebody tried to assassinate Edwin Walker, the general. And I think Bob knows the answer to this. Apparently what happened in April of 1963, when Edwin Walker was a famous person, a notorious person. And by the way, of course, every day, the young student who had been escorted, James Meredith, was escorted to his class by half a dozen U.S. Marshals who sat in the back of the classroom and then escorted him safely out. So getting back to General Edwin Walker, he was a sort of a controversial figure. And in April of 1963, believe it or not, somebody took a pot shot and tried to kill him.
Wow.
And now, Bob, do you know, I'm sure you do, maybe we, yeah, do you know who the alleged gunman was?
Well, again, I just want to mention in this case, you said alleged. He never really had a trial. And some of the witnesses described multiple people leaving the scene of whatever happened there. And I just add anecdotally, we supposedly have a man who shot through a tree at President Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963. And then, you know, was able to make such a remarkable shot at him, while another was quite an awful shot at him and missed. But, you know, from a few feet away by the window, he missed. You know, standing at, say, the den of General Walker, he took a shot, and from a few feet wasn't able to hit him. So that was quite a strange occurrence, in my opinion. But, yes, it was Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, Lee Harvey Oswald, can you believe? Lee Harvey Oswald was supposedly, and I, you know, was the guy that took a pot shot at General Edwin Walker. Now, I don't want to get into a debate here, but why would he try and bump off General Edwin Walker, who was a very completely different character, politically minded than Kennedy? I don't know, but Bob, I'm sure, has an answer. Anyway, I didn't want to go on endlessly, but it was a baptism by fire for me when I was on the campus. And I, again, you don't know about Edwin Walker being shot at until much later. I mean, at least I didn't know. And it was interesting to uncover that little bit of not minutia, but of history. So I've rambled on enough, and I let my esteemed colleague Arthur into the conversation.
Yes. Well, now remember, James Meredith, as Ivor has said, was in school, but he had become a real advocate for voting rights. That's what the big fight was going on for at that time in not only Mississippi, but Alabama and across the South. But those two states, as King is quoted as saying, Alabama was the most segregated state of all in America. Well, you know, we had the Selma to Montgomery March, with King leading that march. Then came Meredith. He had planned to have a march for voting rights across Mississippi. There was really not much coverage of his idea, nor even the night that he got out to start the march. And here he was shot, not critically wounded, thank goodness. And I was leaving our bureau with my engineer at the time. Everybody else had gone home. And we were locking the door when I heard the bulletin on the wire machine go off. And I said to my engineer named Charlie, I said, Charlie, guess what? We're going back in. And we look, and here Meredith has been shot. We fired up the network, and I reported that first moment that what I knew, that Meredith had been shot. Do you know, later, I received a call. I've never been able to verify the fact that it was James Meredith's wife, but she claimed she was, and she heard my broadcast, and that's how she knew her husband had been wounded. I, to this day, don't know whether that was James Meredith's wife. And when James Meredith then started that march after he recovered, Martin Luther King joined it along with all the other civil rights leaders, and it became a huge march. The officials in Mississippi were very upset about it, but it went on, and from my perspective, it was the most difficult march of all the marches that I attended, because the police were so upset that they were having, I'm sure, having to work this march, and they were opposed, of course, to voting rights to begin with, and it was a very miserable time, and the police would flood where we were going to the next spot that we were going to stay, while they would flood that, and we were constantly parading around in the mud all along that march through the state of Mississippi.
Can I ask you both a question before Bob leads us into 1963? Arthur and Ivor both, how old were each of you at this time? And Ivor, an additional piece of that is, did you get any photos of you being, you know, masquerading as a student on the campus?
Unfortunately, I didn't take my iPhone camera with me. No, I mean, I know this sounds remarkable, but because don't forget, in a way, I was supposed to be incognito, and I thought if I went around taking my picture with all the burning cars, people would say, "Who the hell is this guy?" And I was 24 years of age at the time.
Wow.
But can I just, you mentioned, we're talking about 1963. I wanted to mention 1962 because, as the world knows, I think it was in October when there was a Cuban Missile Crisis, which was had the world on the brink of who knows what. And mm-hmm. The reason I bring it up, everyone, is that a couple of months ago I went to Cuba. I finally got to Cuba, and it was the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And strangely enough, nobody kind of bothered. It was just another anniversary. But if you all remember, those of us on the call that are old enough to remember, in 1962, it was pretty, I mean, we were scared. I mean, people were building bomb shelters. People were very worried. And again, I'm going to throw it back to Arthur. Do you remember the Cuban Missile Crisis and the atmosphere that was going on in America? Don't forget, I was only 2 years in America. I was a novice, a neophyte, knew nothing.
Oh, I surely do. You're absolutely right that people were building bomb shelters right in their backyard, and the schools were going through tests on what to do in case a crisis came, and schools everywhere were going through tests with the students and the instructors and teachers. It was a tremendous problem. Yes, I was in and out of Washington during the Cuban Missile Crisis because I was still news director back in Cleveland, and the bureau chief was full-time covering the Cuban Missile Crisis. And you know, Kennedy was very upset because he really did not know what to do. He was very upset at the Bay of Pigs. That was a planned event, and it went badly, as we know. And so there was a lot of friction going on in Washington about the CIA at the time.
Well, Bob, we'll pitch it to you.
Well, it's interesting, like you fellas living through this, you know, that your recounting of it is amazing to listen to. The world they're living at the time with bomb shelters, kids in school, hiding under desks, living through the missile crisis when I believe 100 million people could have died if that had gone wrong. But, you know, some of these characters in Kennedy's joint chiefs, such as General Curtis LeMay, and these guys actually thought that a war like that was winnable, you know. And if we, as you were talking about the civil rights as well, what a contrast. I mean, on one level, you have a president trying to handle things after the Bay of Pigs goes so terribly wrong, and he fired the head of the CIA, Alan Dulles, and he also fired General Charles Cabell, who was the number two man in the CIA, and his brother was the mayor of Dallas, And he also later, we found out through documents, he was also affiliated with the CIA. But Kennedy had a lot of people who looked at him and called him things such as a weak sister, and he should have stood up. Had things gone another way, we could have had 100 million people died. But as we're moving into 1963 and these things going on, what other things come to your mind, Ivor, with the tension in the country, the opposing views, you know, so vehement against each other?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Don't forget, I was a young man at the time, and I had no concept, really no historical concept. It wasn't until a few years later that I sort of wised up a little bit with age. But I'm going to mention something that popped up in my mind when I knew we were going to be talking about 1962 and 1963. Now, in 1977, and this is appropriate but not appropriate. In 1977, I was invited to interview a beautiful lady who reminded me of a young Elizabeth Taylor. Her name was Judith Exner Campbell. Now, the reason I mentioned Judith Exner Campbell, which 99% of listeners probably would say, who the hell is she, is this. And I think Bob, being a historian, and I think Arthur will remember who she was. Now, I interviewed her because she was writing a book about her life. And in the book, one of the most shocking revelations was that in 1962 and 63, she was the mistress of John Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Now the twist on that is, at the same time as she was the mistress and visiting John Kennedy in the White House, she was visiting in the bedroom of Sam Giancana and Johnny Rosselli, two infamous mobsters. So here's this lady telling me how she never passed on secrets to the mob, who were linked to Cuba. And I just wondered, Arthur has a fantastic memory and a great wit. Do you remember Judith Exner Campbell and how scandalous it was at the time, Arthur?
Well, I remember all the stories, et cetera. I was not in Washington permanently. You know, I went there, came back, went there, came back. I did not know whether those stories were accurate or not, but certainly they were abundant in Washington.
Yeah, but let me just interrupt. She said to me, Judith Exner Campbell was very outspoken. She said every time she went to the White House, she signed in at the front door.
Unbelievable.
I didn't know you could sign in at the front door at that time. It was always at the back, where it signed in. But it could have been, because there certainly weren't rules and procedures that go on today and went on right after the assassination in those days. It was much looser.
Yeah.
So, Ivor, what you're telling us is the liaison between Eric Swalwell and his Chinese agent, mistress or girlfriend or whatever she is nothing new, that this is, there's nothing new under the sun, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, we're not here to talk about John Kennedy's morality. But,
right.
But I think, and the only reason I brought it up was, I mean, again, I was fairly naive, and when I went to have lunch with Judith Exner Campbell, and I'd read the book, I thought, you know, this is amazing. How can a lady of the night, or, you know, a classy lady of the night, if you like, end up having a relationship with the President of the United States and one of the most infamous mobsters at the same time.
Right.
But she said she
might I interject with a thought when you finish yours? Forgive me, straining at the leash.
Yeah. Well, maybe Sam Giancana asked her to take notes, but she claimed she was not the go-between between Kennedy and the mob. But what a weird relationship, isn't it? Well, go ahead, Bob, with your opinion.
Well, you were there, so I'd like to run this by you. If Kennedy was simply having a liaison with her and she would come to the White House, she has to sign in. There's a record of it. They could have. Kennedy was quite infamous for, you know, finding other places. But what this also could be, and it's, of course, it's somewhat speculative, but I think it's a thought. At this time, the mafia was being employed, before Kennedy even came into office, to try to off Fidel Castro. And, you know, this Johnny Rosselli, which you guys brought up, was a well-known mobster who was called actually General Rosselli by people in the Cuban operation who were going after Castro. So the mob was very close with the agency at the time, and some have speculated that these plans were somewhat out of control. As we saw with the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy was kind of hoodwinked. He took the responsibility for it, but he fired Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA. Kennedy's historian, Schlesinger, had said he was at war with the intelligence agencies. Now, Ms. Exner said to you, you know, I didn't bring anything back and forth to her. There are some who doubt that. I don't think she'd be very healthy if she said I was bringing President Kennedy documents, but some have wondered if things got so out of control regarding Vietnam, the killing of the Diem brothers and such. They said when Kennedy found out that happened, he was deeply shaken. He turned ashen white and was, he realized things were getting out of control there. Some think that she was a courier, and what he was trying to find out are what the plots were against Castro, which were already in motion, to try to take him out, you know, which involved Rosselli. And it makes some sense. I mean, in a way, Kennedy was very reckless with his womanizing. Again, not to judge his morality, but, he kind of saved us from possible nuclear war. But I wonder about that. Like, you know, she just showed up, she signed in. But meanwhile, she's involved with Sam Giancana and, a man they called General Rosselli in these operations, who is very high up in the assassination game. So I was just wondering what you thought of that.
Well, it's an interesting, I mean, you have to give intelligence and know-how and brilliant strategy in almost a sort of a, what was the spy from Europe, the famous, what's her name now? It'll come to me in a minute.
Mata Hari.
Mata Hari. Okay, was she Kennedy's Mata Hari? I mean, but the history was that Kennedy met her at Frank Sinatra's house in Palm Springs, okay? And that's where he took a shine to her. And, of course, you know, she took a shine to him, not surprisingly. So then we can, I mean, if you want to extrapolate the thing, well, you know, Sinatra had links to the mob. He was a mob-supported guy. And the mob was in Palm Springs. And Frank and Rosselli and Giancana and all the rest of it. It's a wonderful conspiracy thought. And the only other thing I would say was, she said she was not a courier for the mob. Okay, because if she admitted it, Bob, she would have been bumped off, I think. So it was pure hanky-panky, she said. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, listen to me. This man was there and spoke to her in person and in all these places, and I have the temerity to interrupt, but I'd love to pick your brain on this. And thank you for indulging me, sir, since you were in these places and I merely ask and I learn from listening and from books mostly. But so I tip my cap to you. But it came out recently in a Jefferson Morley's done a book. I don't totally trust all his reporting on it, but I interviewed him. And it said when Nixon was getting, in Watergate neck deep, he had gone to Richard Helms and gone to him, and they purport this is on tape, where Nixon basically was saying, you know, we know who killed John, and I'm on board with it, basically, I paraphrase. And, now this has been alluded to on Fox News in the last week or two. And basically it was on tape that Nixon was saying, we know who killed him, and he was trying to negotiate a detente with Richard Helms to protect him from what was happening in Watergate. They said that Nixon, on his tapes, if we go through the tapes, it's not fun listening to thousands of hours of Nixon's tapes. But if you do go through them, it was, I believe, Haldeman said, you know, that Nixon would often refer to this Bay of Pigs thing, and if this opens up, that scab could rock a lot of people. Haldeman came out in his autobiography and said that the Bay of Pigs thing was a Kennedy assassination. So I just throw that in for the text of what we're going through, and the fact that you met Miss Exner, I'm very jealous, and you did some excellent reporting on that. And I nod over back to my friend Jude, and thank you for indulging me, because you fellows know how much time I've spent for good or bad trying to figure this stuff out. So talking to you is like putting me in the candy store with a $50 bill.
Well, I love it. And I was 10 years old, coming up on my 10th birthday in November of 1963. And as a nod to my parents, because I grew up in central Louisiana, in very conservative central Louisiana, and I'd never heard anything, to my knowledge, about negative or otherwise about the civil rights movement. And every night my parents insisted that we not watch the TV while we were eating dinner. I think it's because a lot of this was on television at the time, and it probably would have been very upsetting to know that as a little girl I was living in such turbulent times. I know that when I was in high school and Vietnam was going on, I ended up with a serious ulcer and missed a lot of school because I was so upset about the events of the late 1960s. So a nod to two people living in the Deep South at that time who did not lead me in one direction or the other, but just tried to make life happy as possible. I'm sure they were caught up in it, but I never heard a word about it. And as we move into 1963, to both Ivor and Art, you know, we move into Kennedy really becoming more and more proactive in the civil rights movement. And in April of 1963, we get that unbelievable march on Birmingham, which was just, the intensity level had increased from 62. So it's being led by Dr. Martin Luther King, and whoever wants to go first, Ivor Art, I'd love to hear what you remember about that.
Arthur is really the historian on that, because he covered it on foot. The only thing I can remember, and this was 1964, so I'm going ahead, was that we were on a plane with John Lennon. Remember that guy from the Beatles? I mean, we've almost forgotten them. And somebody, it could have been Art, and he showed him the newspaper from, I think it was the Birmingham riots, and there was an iconic picture on the front page of sheriff's guys with a fierce-looking dog, which was about to attack a black protester. I remember John was pretty appalled by that. Anyway, Arthur, do you remember that? Because banging shoe leather on the road. I was just sitting watching television. Go ahead, Arthur.
No, that's true. And I remember that very well. But as Jude was saying, that march on Alabama, on Birmingham, was, if you now know, that is where we received the famous Martin Luther King letter that he wrote to the ministers. He was very upset with the clergy because of the stand they took regarding civil rights at that time. And he was in jail. All the ministers had been jailed at that time. I think they spent 8 days or so. He wrote that famous letter on scrap paper, toilet paper, whatever he could get. And today, thank goodness, we have that great letter that he wrote. And he and it was his trying to explain why we needed a law, and we also needed to understand that we had to do it nonviolently. And that was a great era in this country, in Alabama, where it will go down in history, that march. And then what the children came about, because they decided to have children do the march, and the officials hated that, and they turned the dogs, and they were treating the children like they were trying to treat all the other marchers that they loved to beat up and abuse. And when the people saw that, that turned the tide, and Kennedy really then got into it. But it's a whole story now that we won't get into, about how Kennedy, the same with Johnson, they didn't have the votes. Martin Luther King, at the very early part, didn't understand that. Or at least that was many of our views, that he didn't understand that they didn't have the votes, and you couldn't get it into law without the votes. And so that was really the real change in civil rights, that Kennedy didn't receive the glory, but Lyndon Johnson did, because Lyndon Johnson managed to get the Voting Rights Bill, the Civil Rights Bill, of course, Medicare, and he did the whole era that was called what he named it, and that was what he wanted. And Kennedy and he worked very hard on getting that accomplished.
Yeah, Dr. King in many ways was, you have dreamers like Kennedy was he could see the future and he had great visions and plans for the future, but Dr. King put a lot of what Thoreau would say, if you have castles in the air, now put the foundation under them. And so Dr. King is putting a foundation under these great ideas, and he called the march on Birmingham Project C, which stood for Project Confrontation. And he wanted to confront, but he wanted to confront peacefully, but confront nonetheless. And in the months that followed this April March on Birmingham, he stages sit-ins in drugstores and stores and public transportation and restaurants. And as we move into the hot summer of 1963, he begins pressing for the integration of schools, including the University of Alabama. And Governor George Wallace is standing firm against integration on any level. So, Art, we'll start with you, and then we'll go over to Ivor. What do you remember about George Wallace and the move, the push for integration in the autumn of 1963?
Well, I remember we all went there because he said, I'll stand in the door and no one is going to cross. He was not going to allow a black into the University of Alabama. And Johnson, the president, then he deputized the National Guard of Alabama and made them national, and they then defended the right to go into the school, George Wallace stood in the door. A man by the name of Katzenbach, who later became the attorney general, but he was a deputy, I think, attorney general at the time. He met with Wallace, read the law, that had been passed, that had been written out by the Justice Department. And Wallace said, I'm not going to do it. But it was later that Wallace had to give in, and that was how. And there were two individuals, two students. I remember the one woman, because I did talk to her. Vivian was her first name. I don't remember the last name. And there was a man by the name of Hood, and I, James Hood, but I did not ever interview him.
Ivor, did you have any contact with either of those individuals?
The answer is no, and my excuse is this, that I was a 24-year-old Englishman who was fresh in America. I was a freshman when it came to the American Civil Rights campaign. So all I could do is look on, wonder what it was all about, although I quickly learned what it was all about when James Meredith was enrolled. So I cannot offer any sage advice like Arthur did, because I wasn't, I mean, we covered the civil rights movement, Washington, we had a bureau in Washington, but I was just dumb at the time, really. Not very knowledgeable. I'm marginally more knowledgeable today, but so I can't bring the wisdom. The only thing I do remember that Arthur said was that Kennedy started it all, and LBJ, even though he was the poor man's vice president, you know, the Kennedy brothers kind of ignored him and put him in his place. When LBJ, as Arthur said a few minutes ago, got into the Oval Office, he was an action man. He was the kind of guy that went around and knew how to twist elbows, the kind of guy we actually probably need in Washington, D.C. today. So Lyndon got things done, as Arthur said.
Yeah. Well, we've kind of covered our next question because we were going to kind of take a step back and look at Ole Miss, and we've done that. So, Bob, I will pass it over to you.
Well, Bob, just a moment. Yes. I just want to tell you, this happened the night that James Meredith was shot when he tried to start the march across Mississippi. And I told you I was leaving the bureau with my engineer. We heard the bullets, and we went back in, fired up the network. And I grabbed the phone and called. James Eastland was the longtime senator from Louisiana, and he was also a very anti-black person who did not want any integration. And I just thought of him, and I grabbed the phone book. I called his number. His wife answered, and she thought I had said, I learned this later from her, she thought I had said, when I said I'm Art Shriver, she thought I said I was Sarge Shriver. If you remember, Sarge Shriver was a brother-in-law of Jack Kennedy. He ran the Peace Corps. So she handed the phone to her husband. And when I said, Senator, this is Art Shriver, Westinghouse Broadcasting Company, he was obviously furious with her, but it was too late. He goes, and I said, I'd like your comment. James Meredith has been shot, blah, blah, blah. And he's going, and he hung up. Uh-huh. And years later, we did talk about that, and he would kid me about the fact that he claims that I was deliberately sounding like I said Sarge Shriver so people would answer the phone. But that was a very humorous event on a tragic night.
Yeah.
Now, that is a wonderful story, Arthur. And you can just see it. It's almost like a comedy of errors, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
If you had said Sarge Schreiber, I think that would have been a brilliant tactical move. But as it is, you were being honest, and that makes it even better.
Okay.
All right, Bob, we'll throw it to you.
Well, it's an incredible anecdote, but Ivor, I have to jump to you on that one. You have related to me in the past graciously your own encounter with Sergeant Schreiber. Would you just want to mention that one? It's just the way things in life sometimes come together can be quite fascinating.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, what was happening was, we're going to fast forward to 1960, was it 68? I just got my 68. I was covering Bobby Kennedy, his campaign for president in California. To cut a long story short, I was at the Ambassador Hotel that night when Kennedy claimed victory over Eugene McCarthy. And we knew that with all the electoral votes for California that Bobby was going to go to Chicago to the convention, and he would probably have been nominated as the Democratic candidate for president. And he wanted it very much indeed. However, as the world knows, that night at the Ambassador Hotel, and I always say that I heard 4, 5, 6, 7 balloons bursting, but then I realized it wasn't balloons bursting because people were screaming. And I walked into the kitchen and the parlor, and there was Bobby bleeding on the floor. Now, before I was able to push my way into the parlor of the kitchen at the Ambassador Hotel that terrible night, a man who was Sarge Schreiber tried to block my way. And being, I mean, I wasn't aggressive, but I thought, I've got to go through what the heck is going on in that little alcove. I could see Bobby on the floor. And Sergeant Schreiber grabbed me by the shirt, and I said, I'm coming through. And I pushed my way through, and he hung on to my shirt, and he ripped my shirt sleeves completely off my, almost off my arm.
Wow.
I pushed past him, and there was Bobby. So that was my bizarre, horrible encounter with Schreiber.
Yeah, wow. Oh.
This is a strange question to ask, admittedly, because it's not something one would normally do unless they had the presence of mind after such a horrible event that you were so close to, which obviously would be something you'll never forget, quite traumatizing. After that happened, did you dispose of the shirt, or I don't mean keep it as a souvenir and you know, in a macabre way, but did you just go home and change, and that shirt was you know, that must have had quite an effect on you?
Well, it did. I mean, to be honest with you, I didn't have the sense to put it in aspic and frame it. I mean, what I did was I wore it the rest of the night, and then I wore it when we went to the hospital. I wore it until 3 o'clock in the morning. And I finally, after 3 o'clock in the morning, and then they told us that, I forget whether it was the same night or hours later, that Bobby had died. Mankiewicz got up there and said, Bobby. And I just, you know, I just carried on normally without thinking, well, history is in the making. I don't think you do that. I mean, maybe when you're older and wiser you do, but that shirt is long gone into the dumpster.
Yeah,
I was just curious because I know you lived through it, and that was the answer I suspected, but because it would have gnawed at me, thank you for indulging that question. It would be a strange, you know, a hard thing to hold on to each time you held it. I'm sure it would bring the memories back. And you're quite a brave fellow, being in all these touchy situations. You guys both walked in rather boldly, so I commend your bravery and your as you're doing your jobs.
Amen.
I'd just like to bring up one fellow.
Arthur, it's not bravery, really, Bob. I mean, I would not call any of the coverage of the stories brave. I mean, I was in the Watts riots and people were shooting at me, but I just thought, well, I've got to get the story, you know. So I'm going to ask Arthur this. Arthur, did you ever go into a story saying, I better be brave? Thinking that this is going to be You're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to be courageous. You're going to have to be brave. Did you ever use that attitude in your skull, in your mind?
If you remember, Ivor, police in those days loved to get, say there was a rope to that you were not to cross. And so we got up against the rope. Police would back up and be in front of us, but holding their billy club horizontally under their arm, but holding on to it with their fist. And they would love to back up against you and then and move that billy club real fast backwards, and it would catch you right in the stomach or the chest. And that was a favorite trick of police all over the South in those days.
Were you ever scared out of your wits covering those stories, or did you grit your teeth and say, I'm doing my job?
I'll tell you why I was. I was deathly afraid of Molotov cocktails. And we experienced constantly the throwing of Molotov cocktails down at the press. And I don't know whether you know a Molotov cocktail. It's, some inflammable liquid. They say sometimes gasoline, but I've heard that it's even more explosive and fire. It catches fire quicker than gasoline. Whatever that was, I don't know. But that, and they would light the fuse and throw it down. Well, when it hit the pavement, of course the glass would shatter and fire would go everywhere, and then suddenly it kind of explode up. And I was deathly afraid that I was going to get hit or really burned by a Molotov cocktail. I worried about it in every riot I ever covered.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to throw one last question out because we're coming up on 6 o'clock and I know you guys have other things to do, and we're going to do a part three. We're going to come back next time and talk about Lyndon Baines Johnson and as he became president, the changes he made. And we'll also trace the Beatles, who were quietly on the rise in England at this time and exploded the next year in 1964 like a Molotov cocktail and burned very brightly for the next 6 or 7 years, and of course are still burning brightly today. But I'm posing this question to you as well as to Ivor and Art, because President Kennedy's reaction to the March on Washington in August of 1963 was to pledge that he was going to pass a monumental civil rights bill by the end of 1963. And some people were rejoicing over this, and other people, as you know from what you've seen and the telephone call you made, Art, and what you saw in the riots, some people were furious. And that was foremost in the minds of a lot of people when President Kennedy and First Lady Jackie Kennedy decided they were going to travel into the South, into Dallas, in late November of 1963. So to all of you, what do you recall about that event? Because Bob's probably studied it more than anybody on planet Earth. And was there any feeling or premonition ahead of time that this might not be the right move, that this trip might be dangerous? So why don't you want to throw it? Ivor, do you want to go to you first?
Well, I'll just say, because really, as I said earlier in the conversation, I was a total freshman. I didn't have any historical background to the American Civil Rights Movement. I just watched it. I was appalled by what was going on. I mean, I remember all the stuff about drugstores where you know, things going on, and I was basically a spectator. So I'm going to. And don't forget, I wasn't American, and that kind of that's the reason for for being fairly dumb and unknowledgeable about the civil rights movement of what you've just asked for. So I'm going to pass the buck back to Arthur and to Bob and to you.
And Jude Ivor couldn't afford another shirt.
And you wait a minute. So I think you lost two suits. Correct me if I'm wrong. Two suits, two typewriters, and three or four, or maybe more, shirts on the 1964 tour with the Beatles. So you guys had to have a wardrobe accommodation, if you ask me.
Yes, I'm sorry that I didn't try to sell my suits that were torn. But maybe I could have made enough money to pay for the trip covering the Beatles.
I would have bought it.
Well, I don't know whether Ivor experienced that, but the women had long fingernails in those days, and they would grab you and then just pull down, and those nails would go in the fabric and it just rip it. And I lost three suits on the Beatles tour that way.
See, I was underestimated.
I must just add a footnote to that, because Arthur will remember this. Also on the tour with us was a fellow called George Harrison. Now, not the George Harrison, but a Liverpool Echo writer called,
yes,
George Harrison, who was not related to George, but liked to tell people he was. And I always remember, and Arthur was probably there, we arrived at the hotel, and the girls started surrounding us all, and somehow George Harrison, the elder, suitcase opened, and all his stuff fell out on the floor, and the girls pounced on it like it was booty, like it was gold. And poor old George Harrison lost almost as much clothing as Arthur Schreiber.
Yes, he was laying under the cab. The cab driver grabbed his piece of luggage that I swear was in the Battle of Trafalgar. It was so old and deteriorated, and the kid grabbed a hold of it. It fell open, and everything went out. I say today that there are people who have Paul, have George Harrison's underwear, and they... Not George Harrison, the Beatle. It's George Harrison, the columnist.
That's so funny. I love it. Oh, we have to laugh because this is it's a pretty serious show. We've talked about some really tragic events, but we needed that moment of levity. So, all right, Art, we're going to have to, did you ever have in your mind that it might not be wise for Kennedy to travel to Dallas?
No, I didn't. But there were a lot of people that were afraid, and they were right. But no, I didn't think of him being in jeopardy. I just I don't know why, but I didn't.
Now, Bob, did you, as you look back on it in retrospect from all the great amount of study that you've done, do you see earmarkers that it wasn't a great idea, or was there no way that people could have known?
I'm going to try to give you the speed answer, and then I ask that you would have the honor of closing the show out for us after I answer, because you put this together and did such a great job with these guys and looking into the year. I'd just like to say, because obviously I've spent a lot of time on this stuff, so I just wanted to add, there were threats on Kennedy in Miami and Chicago prior to Dallas. In Miami, they had to cancel his motorcade, and there was a tape made of surveillance, which had been done by somebody who was in some of the far-right organizations. His name was Joseph Miltier, and on tape he said, Kennedy's going to be killed from an office building with a high-powered rifle. It's in the works.
Wow.
Now, if this was nothing, I doubt Mr. Miltier would have been being taped and surveilled by the authorities in Florida had he not been a serious character. So his motorcade was canceled. He then went to Chicago, where someone with a very similar background to Lee Harvey Oswald, Thomas Arthur Valley, was picked up, and some people were arrested and held in Kennedy. They said he had a cold, and Pierre Salinger announced that, and then they sent Kennedy back to the White House. Both of those were because of plots. Wow. I'd just like to give him a nod. I know we're running out of time, but I like to mention him. I had the honor to speak to him. Abraham Bolden was the first African-American Secret Service agent. He was spotted by Kennedy. Kennedy liked him very much and bumped him up. He alleged that there were agents speaking that they hated Kennedy because of his racial policies and who said they wouldn't protect him. He was then charged with a crime and was in prison for a time. He served his time. Now, he was pardoned last year that he was innocent, and he was targeted, I believe, and his pardon would sort of back that up, that he had spoken out and said that they said they weren't going to protect, so not all of them, agents in the, you know, who were protecting Kennedy, some of them had said they wouldn't take a bullet for him, called him horrible names, racially motivated and such. So you had Miami and Chicago calling off a motorcade. You had Kennedy not going to the big Army-Navy football game in Chicago and going back to the White House. And then you had a Secret Service agent who came forward, was then later framed and now pardoned about a year ago. So it took that long for him to be pardoned. So then Kennedy's brother Robert, I'll close with, had said that he thought he would be the one who would be killed. He didn't think it would be John. So I do believe there was ample evidence that Kennedy was being stalked through those cities.
Wow. It's just chilling. And, you know, now we know so much more, but I don't think, and Bob, you'll have to fill us in on this, but we still don't know the whole story, do we?
Well, I was shocked, and I know I've drawn on about this, but it is because I've felt so passionately about it, and Ivor knows so much about it, and we have, you know, Arthur here, who's such an, you know, established journalist, that I was shocked that finally, I don't trust their reporting on the Kennedy story for many reasons, that I don't insult the media or the gentleman we have on. I just, this story in particular has been very misreported, and again, when I mentioned Abraham Bolden, he's pardoned. So this isn't saying I think he was, you know, didn't do anything wrong. The man was pardoned. Now it took all this time, but that Tucker Carlson, who's on Fox, had come out in the last month and twice stated as fact that Kennedy had been killed by the agency. So I have to ask myself, they've never really done any reporting on that that was fair and balanced. And I'm not saying I have to be right. You know, someone can argue and prove me wrong. You know, I see a lot of facts though, but. The only other reporting they'd done in their existence, and I'd seen, you know, looked for anything they had on it, was Greta Van Susteren did one report that wasn't horrible, I would say. That's my evaluation of their coverage. Now it's coming out where Carlson is talking about the tape where Nixon had said, you know, we know who took John out, and this is to Richard Helms, the director of the agency. And he was trying to basically say, in my interpretation, and you can look this up, it's now public knowledge, and it came out on Fox last week, although I did a show on it about 6 months ago. I guess I was able to somehow beat Fox News to this information when it was out there. But, you know, Nixon had basically said, was basically saying to Helms, some of your guys were involved in this, and make Watergate go away. And he said, basically, I'm paraphrasing, it had to happen. So this has now been acknowledged by Fox News. I know some people hate Fox News. I'm not saying they're the greatest or the worst. I'm just saying this is out in the public arena if you'd like to look into it further. And it seems that President Kennedy, it's a very hard case to prove to someone who's never gone to court, never had his day in court, yet we talk about him as an assassin, and the evidence doesn't seem to stack up, in my opinion.
Right.
But on that, you guys did a wonderful job, and thank you for indulging me in bringing that, because we lost him, and we also lost Martin, and we also lost Robert, and I think our country changed dramatically for the worse, and I know next time maybe we'll get into John, Paul, George, and Ringo more, but thank you for bringing up the things you did and sharing those wonderful memories, and Jude, I hand it to you.
Well, we thank you so much, Art and Ivor, both, for sharing the second hour with us as we look back at 1963. And we aren't finished yet, so we want to do one more show in which we talk about Lyndon Baines Johnson and the war in Vietnam and the rise of the Beatles. So, audience, everyone out there, we are looking forward to one more chat with Arthur Schreiber from the Westinghouse Network, who, as Ivor said, was banging out leather on the beat, right there reporting everything, and Ivor Davis, who was the foreign correspondent for the London Daily Express, and who was not just at the James Meredith entry into Ole Miss and was then later with Bobby Kennedy, but he also was the only journalist to tour with the Beatles from day one to day end in 1964. And Art joined him in Atlantic City and was there for a large portion of that tour as well. So we have lots of good information to come. So thank you very much for being part of part one and part two, and we look forward to part three on Don't Pass Me By with your host, Bob Wilson, who has generously let me chime in this time. Bob, thank you for having all of us.
Well, you were the star today, and you brought these guys on, and they're legends in and of themselves, and it was a pleasure and an honor to have you guys come on to this show and bring it up a notch in respectability. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.